Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Optusport Football Podcast. I'm Mark Schwarzer and today I'm joined by European football expert Julien Laurens and also Phil Kitchmalidis, who tweeted this last week. Yesterday morning, first thing my six-year-old asked to watch was the highlights of Celta against Cadiz. Now we're happily watching Yeclano against Rayo Vallecano in the second round of Copa del Rey. So yeah, I reckon there might be hope yet. Jules, what do you reckon about, what do you reckon actually happened in this tweet?
Hi, Schwarzy. Hi, Phil. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm glad at least he didn't ask to see, you know, Tottenham Hotspur's trophy cabinet or the recent trophies that they won or something like that. At least he's still very hipsters, you know?
you know, the thing is about that, actually, where you said about wanting to see their trophy cabinet. I mean, I'm I know back in history, there's a few trophies in that cabinet. That's not a problem. I thought he might ask, actually, Dad, why are we even bothering with Spurs?
Guys, why are these two-footed challenges coming in right at the start of the podcast, man? Absolutely nailing me.
It's because we love you, really.
All right, okay.
We like your reactions.
Strange way of showing it, guys. Yeah, I mean, listen, my six-year-old is completely obsessed with football, and it was, really quite heartening, you know, when he wakes up and says, can I watch the highlights? What happened? Celta against Cadiz? What happened? I feel like, yeah, my job is done here. My work is done. We're on the right path, so yeah.
And Yeclano Rayo, what was that like?
It was terrible. It was a terrible game, but we are Rayo season ticket holders. So we sat down and watched it, and they scraped through 2-0 and into the next round. So there we go.
But you realize just because you're season ticket holders, when they're playing away from home, you don't have to actually watch it.
Yeah, but you know, you have to experience some of the lows as well. It can't just be all the highs of, oh yeah, when we got a draw against Real Madrid, a draw against Barca, and you know, this is all fun. You've got to watch them scrape in the mud against some part-timers on a Tuesday afternoon to fully, you know, be a proper Rayo fan.
Did you recognize the quality of the game? Did he say like, oh dad, this is not good, really? What? Yeah, okay.
He did. He said, Daddy, this isn't very good. Really? It was a bit like when we were watching Fulham Man United a couple of weeks ago, and he said, Daddy, this isn't very good. Can we put something else on? So yeah.
Yeah, so what's the secret? How have you got him into it so much?
Well, I guess sort of total immersion in football from a very, very, very young age has basically been the trick. So, yeah, obviously, I watch a lot of football, talk about a lot of football. We play a lot of football. So just as well, he likes it.
Indoctrination at its finest. We all love it, don't we? Absolutely. Well, let's get on to Manchester United against Bournemouth. What a game, by the way. I mean, booed off at halftime at 1-0 down. And they were obviously booed even more by whoever were left in the stadium because there weren't many fans left in the stadium. This result has been coming though, Julien, hasn't it, for Manchester United?
Yeah, it has. However, I never thought that it could get this bad. And Bournemouth are one of the teams in form in the Premier League. There was the fourth win out of five. So they were doing well. But they'd never won at Old Trafford, for example, ever in their whole history. And for them to go, and it's not just winning, it's just humiliating United in the sense that they could have won 5-0 easily. It was just mind-blowing in the sense that you're watching the game on a Saturday, it's a 3 o'clock kickoff. So, you know, your weekend has started, there was an early kickoff game. So, you know, you get excited by the weekend and you sit down and for all the thought that you could have on a United-Bournemouth game, how could it go? You know, what could be the good thing, the bad thing? Never in a million years I thought I could see that. But it shows again that, one, United don't have much margin this season anyway. And two, as soon as they play against a good team, with a plan, with a good structure, in possession and out of possession, they are completely lost because themselves don't have a plan and don't have a structure in possession or out of possession.
It was striking, wasn't it? Like the contrast in the two teams in terms of an idea, an identity, and Bournemouth are very, very clear in what they want to do. And Manchester United, still aren't. We still don't really know how Ten Hag wants them to play. And if you look at, I mean, the first two goals come from clear Manchester United errors, just giving the ball away. But it's not just the Manchester United errors, is it? It's the Bournemouth pressing, harassing, chasing into space and capitalising them as well. So it was really quite interesting to see the deep contrast between these two sides. Credit to Bournemouth. We'll talk about them a little bit later, I guess. But I mean, in terms of United, how many times have we said on the pod this season, is this a turning point? Is this the lowest? It just all seems really extreme for Manchester United. And at the same time, I don't think anything's going to change. I mean, who is going to change the manager if we're talking about a managerial change? Because the ownership situation is so up in the air that no one's there to make real decisions. It just feels like another one of these results, and they'll just keep limping along this season. They might get something against Liverpool at the weekend, but it just doesn't feel like there'll be any continuity this season. And before that, of course, they've got the Bayern Munich game in the Champions League. Their season could be more or less over in terms of actually trying to achieve something or improve on last season by this time next week. It's really bizarre.
I want to mention with Manchester United and obviously Ten Hag's selections for the game. I mean, playing Anthony Martial up front, I don't remember a player that has struggled as often as he has put in so many poor performances, but every time still gets another chance, Jules. I mean, is it bizarre? Like, is it just me, or am I being overcritical and harsh?
No, I mean, I like him a lot because he's one of mine. You know, he's a Paris kid as well. I've known him since he was 15, and at 15 years old.
But he hasn't done well, has he? He struggled.
No, you're right, Rosie. Although, look at the Everton game, which they won 3-0. And again, it's a game where they were not the best team, but they still managed to win, to go back to the limping point that Phil just made. But Martial scored one and got a penalty for the second one. So if you look at Haaland and Haaland's performances in the Premier League this season, so forget about Haaland in the Champions League, which seems to be his twin brother that is much better. But actually, the Haaland in the Premier League with zero goals and zero assists and some big misses at times and some games where he's completely anonymous, Martial against Everton actually gave you more than what Haaland has given you all season long. So I don't know. I'm with you in the sense that he's underachieving, Martial, for the talent that he has. And I think the attitude is a problem. The personality is a problem, as much as I love him. So for me to say that, there must be really a problem. Ten Hag has always been a fan because I think a Martial in the right attitude and the right mindset with all the talent, I think is a perfect Ten Hag player because he can do everything. He's got pace. He's so good on the ball. He's a really clever footballer, but it's just not working. But would you rather put Haaland there with the Haaland that we've seen in the Premier League, which is really, really bad? Or Martial? I think he's like the least of the two worst, if that makes sense. But I can see why, you would not be happy with Martial starting. Well, a lot of United fans are not happy. I'm not sure how happier they would be with Haaland, to be fair.
The thing about Haaland is, at least I feel, I mean, I'm one of these people that also, and I'm a bit like the fans in some way, you feel like something could happen, would happen with Haaland, with the work rate, with the approach to the game. Even though at times it hasn't been great, right? But it's the work rate, the intent is there. With Martial, body language, the seemingly lack of effort. I don't want to believe that a player goes on the pitch not wanting to try, right? I don't believe that. Sometimes players can throw their toys out of the pram. I don't think Anthony Martial does that. I think there's a serious issue with the body language, with his approach to the game in that sense. There's clearly a talented player there, because every single manager that's been there since Martial's been there have always utilized him, have always gone, always given him an opportunity. So there's no doubting that. It's just that he's failed to deliver time and time again. One game against Everton is not enough for me.
No, that's true.
It's a bit like Paul Pogba. I mean, phenomenal talent, but in my opinion, probably certainly in a Manchester United shirt, in my opinion, never gave 90 minutes of football at world-class level. And Martial, very few and far between.
No, just before Phil comes in, isn't it, though, the role of a manager and a good manager to make sure that the talent that Anthony Martial clearly has, because we know he has it, is more consistently used by himself, that you can change the attitude? I'm sure you've been with managers, and we talked about Ange the last time I was with you on the show, and how good of a man manager he was. Isn't it the role of a manager as well to I don't know, maybe sit down with Martial and try to change that mindset, try to change the body language, try to make him work harder, those kind of things. Isn't it a bit of Ten Hag's job as well as the tactics and everything else?
But hasn't it been four or five managers?
No,
I don't
true.
Think four or five managers
yeah,
are
yeah,
wrong,
no, that's true.
Right? I don't think you can blame four or five managers for a player's seemingly lack of attitude or problem with his attitude, Phil, mm-hmm. right?
No, absolutely. I mean, to take it to a sort of more general level rather than speaking
don't
about...
Don't sit on the fence,
of...
give it to him, go on. No, you know no. Julian loves him, but be honest.
I'm going to go back to an article that I think I've quoted previously on the podcast, but it was written and published on the 1st of October. So we're talking about, you know, over two and a half months ago in The Athletic. And the headline is Manchester United simply do not create enough chances or score enough goals. And it's a very simple headline, but it really encapsulates where we're at. And we can talk about whether Hoyland or whether Martial should be starting. But it's deeper than that. I think it's deeper than these sort of individual problems and preferences of one striker or another. It feels structural. It feels like that whether or not your strikers take the chances is one thing, but the actual chance creation is sort of way down for United. And they've only scored 18 goals this season. That's low. That's low for Manchester United. It's half of what Liverpool have scored. And there is a problem with strikers not taking their chances, but I think it's more structural in terms of the actual chances that are created are not good enough quality. So,
I mean, the big question mark is though, let's be honest, Ten Hag's recruitment. If you look at Onana, Amrabat, Anthony, Hoyland, all of them they've shown glimpses, but have struggled in general, have struggled. So every one of his players recruited specifically for him, by him, have struggled. And we're talking about, I mean, let's be honest, in the last couple of months, particularly Harry Maguire being one of their best players, McTominay being one of their best players, even though McTominay I thought was poor against Bournemouth the other day and, you know, was at fault for some of the goals. But in general, he's been one of their better players as well. So that is a big, big concern for Manchester United. They just seem all over the place, lacking confidence, no real leaders, which has been talked about for however many years now. It just goes on and on. But let's not go away from the fact that Bournemouth, how good were Bournemouth, and yeah. They completely deserve to win the game. And Phil, this is your opportunity. Areola.
Listen, this was a perfect example of Iraola ball. And
sorry, I got the pronunciation wrong. Yeah, I knew you were going to correct me. You do that really well, actually, without saying to me, no, Mark, you got that wrong. You give me the proper pronunciation. I love it.
Good, yeah. Shall we practice it together? Iraola.
I think I need to do a session with you offline. I mean, okay. We could do it online. Maybe it will be another podcast. Who knows?
Areola is the French goalkeeper at West Ham.
I know, but I like him as well. Like, I like him as well. That's why I said it.
Yeah, although, yeah, I'm not sure we should talk about him today. But yeah, no. let's talk about Iraola and praise him. And he was... under a bit of pressure, I think it's fair to say, and I might have tweeted when the deal confirmed for him to join Bournemouth. I tweeted something, you know, he's a fantastic manager, enjoy him after leaving Rio. And then I had loads of Bournemouth fans at the start of the season go, he's rubbish, what are we doing? This is, look at us, we can't win a game, blah, blah, blah. And it turns out he just needed a bit of time to implement his very clear ideas. And we're seeing it now. And we saw the intensity, the high pressure and the volume. And he's all about volume. He's all about numbers. He's all about, with Rio, certainly last season, it was about loads of bodies forward, loads of passes forward, loads of balls into the box. And there's a Spanish word, which doesn't necessarily have a direct translation into English. And it's vertical. Literally, it's vertical. His teams go forward. They bring the ball forward. And it's not quite being direct, because direct has these connotations of lumping the ball up and long balls like that. And it's not necessarily like that. It's being on the front foot and going forward. And he is really, really a great proponent of that. And we saw that at Old Trafford as well. And what I was saying earlier, a couple of those goals came from them being on the front foot, going forward and getting to those 50-50 balls. And he's a terrific young manager. We knew it because we saw what he did with some really lowly teams in Spain, not just Rio, but before that, Mirandés in the second division took them to the Copa del Rey semi-finals. He's a terrific guy with some really, really good ideas. And he's been given a little bit of margin here to work with, because it felt like the pressure was on him immediately at Bournemouth, and they didn't do anything silly. They believed that they got the right man, and we saw that the weekend.
And he's making Dominic Solanke look like a very, very good player, and probably fulfilling that potential that everyone probably thought he had at Chelsea. He was showing signs for, went to Liverpool, didn't quite work out, but at Bournemouth, has been exceptional. Let's move on to Everton against Chelsea. I mean, first and foremost, you've got to say Everton. What a response. Sean Dyche, you know, not lumping the ball, playing football. Everton, we talked about, a lot of people talked about in the press, it was going to unify Everton. The 10-point deduction was going to unify the club, the players and everything else. And we're seeing it now, aren't we, Julian?
Completely. Three wins in a row, I think, for the first time in 3 years in the league. Really, and it's not just winning, because sometimes we've said it many times on the show, you can win, but you don't really deserve to win. You're not playing well. They lost against United at Goodison Park. We mentioned when Anthony Martial scored, when they were the better side. They just didn't take their chances. The XG was far better than the non-XG from United on that game, for example, and they lost. But in those three wins, and especially on Sunday against Chelsea, they were the better team. They were really good against Newcastle. They were really good again. Sometimes you benefit from opposition's mistake. That's okay. But they took their chance as well. And I love the fact that Doucouré is the kind of this, not just the engine of this team, but he's been scoring. He's been the heart of what Everton has done. And when you have those kind of players that you can rely on, it's not just him, but Tarkowski, Pickford, even in goal. Dwight McNeil has been in great form too for them. It's just, you know that the momentum is there. You know the character would be there. And we talked a little bit earlier about Martial, body language, et cetera, et cetera. With Everton, the character that they've showed, especially after that 10-point deduction that you mentioned, Schwarzy, is really remarkable.
Phil, Poch in trouble?
Well, he's in trouble because Chelsea are where they are in the league. I mean, I don't think he's in trouble in terms of losing his job anytime soon. But, you know, Chelsea 12th and 14 points off a Champions League spot is not where they were supposed to be. And there's been a lot of discussion of him suggesting that they need to go back into the transfer market and people balking at this idea and thinking, you know, what are they talking about? They spent £1 billion and you need to go back into the transfer window. I think they might. I think they do. I think the fact that they've spent £1 billion is okay. There has been money to spend, but they are wildly overpaid for some players. I mean, that figure has been inflated by some really, really inflated transfer fees, which they've paid, and they've brought players in. And those players obviously aren't 100, 150 million quid players, or they're not playing like that at the moment. They need a striker. The loss of Christopher Nkunku so far has been really telling, and even more so because my tip at the start of the season as a player to watch out for, Nicholas Jackson, has not lived up to the expectation I had from him. Maybe I was putting too much hope on him because of the way he finished last season with Villarreal in absolutely explosive, spectacular fashion, but he hasn't looked like that striker this season at all. Someone who's quick to make decisions, someone who's full of confidence, someone who knows exactly where they need to be, and he's not been that, and he didn't start this game. He came on and didn't look like a striker that was going to score anytime soon. So yeah, they need someone to come in January to try and help them score more goals, because you can't put all your hopes on Nkunku coming back, because he's a young striker in a new division coming back from a long injury. So all the hopes can't be on him. So yeah, it might seem ridiculous him saying we need to spend a bit more money, we need to bring some more players in. But I think they do, because the squad's unbalanced. You know, there's a lot of depth in certain positions, and then in other positions, they look a bit light.
But interestingly, you say that about Nicholas Jackson, right? So last season, he scored 12 goals for Villarreal. Yeah,
but all of them came in like the last 3 months of the season or 2 months of the season or something.
But if you talk about the course of the season, he scored 6 goals this season in 15 games, right? So it's on course for what he did at Villarreal. And that's the point, right? So have they signed a player that is a team, you know, that are fourth, fifth, sixth or seventh, whatever it is in La Liga, sometimes a little bit higher, sometimes a little bit lower. So is that a type of player they've signed? That's the big question, right? What I want to know also, Jules, is more importantly, is about Nkunku. Is he their answer? He's more like, he's kind of like, he's not a number nine. He's a more of a wider player, in my opinion, watching him play lots of times in the Bundesliga. Is he going to be Chelsea's answer in terms of goal, delivering goals?
So I think he can. It would be, I mean, the question mark is how long will he need to adapt to the Premier League, considering he has not played yet in the league. And like Phil said, he's just coming back from a 4-month long injury. He might need a bit of time just to get used to a new league, new culture, new team, new teammates, et cetera, et cetera. As a goal scorer and like a good finisher, he's got that, no problem. As a lone striker, I'm not convinced. The times he did really well at Leipzig was with another striker next to him, whether that was Andre Silva, Yusuf Poulsen. It was just never him. and a 10 behind him in a 4-2-3-1 formation or a 4-3-3, for example, because he would not be the best at holding up the ball, for example. This is not why he doesn't link up the play, really. He's that second striker, great second striker. He can play a bit deeper, can play wide, but no, I don't think as a lone striker in the Premier League, especially. So we will have to see how Poch uses it. The problem I have is not so much is Nkunku the answer or not. I'm sure he will do well. He's a super talented kid. It's like, does even Poch has an idea how to play him, where to play him? Because right now, there's no plan. We said the same about United, but Chelsea are the same. They're just even worse. They have no plan, no structure, no idea, nothing. They're just a very intense team because they're quite young and Gallagher runs forever and Caicedo can run forever and Enzo as well. But in terms of structure and patterns of play and things like that, they have nothing. So bringing Nkunku in just like this and say, hey, Christopher, show us what you can do, it's just not going to work. So I agree with Phil in the sense Poch is not going to get sacked. They can't sack another manager again. It's already the fourth that they've had in 18 months. It's not after Tuchel, Potter, Lampard, and now Poch. So they will give him time. I'm more worried about what is Poch doing even. Like, come on, man. It's mid-December now. I was all okay at the start of the season to give him time and say, listen, we're not going to see an improvement too quickly. But we talked about Iraola with a clear idea. We talked about Unai Emery the other day when I was with you, Schwarzy, with a clear idea. Poch has no idea at all. And we're mid-December now. He's been here since the end of June. I mean, come on.
I think we've also seen as well this season, haven't we, with Chelsea, that they've struggled against teams that defend quite deep against them. So against the Manchester City, that wild game a couple of weeks ago, and we thought, oh, we're seeing signs of Chelsea improving here. It's because they had space for those young players to run into. But against a really organised Everton team, they found it very difficult to break them down. They struggled against Nottingham Forest. They struggled against Villa. They struggled against Bournemouth, against Brentford, to break down teams that don't offer them these kind of spaces. It's difficult for them. And I just checked on Nicholas Jackson, Schwarzy, and I thought I had something in the back of my head. And three of those six goals came in that really weird game against Spurs.
Yeah, against 11, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Of course, but he's still got six goals, right? So, yeah, I know what you're saying. But, yeah. Jules, interestingly, about Poch, I want to ask you, because of him being at PSG, is it a club thing? Like a big club where there's expectations to deliver silverware? Spurs was a club that... Of course they want to win silverware. The fans are crying out for it. Phil cries every night to bed after a weekend's game because
they didn't sign anyone at Spurs. They barely signed anyone at Spurs.
Well, that's
they
went the thing, on and right? did that. But let's give him credit, right? Because he turned a lot of those players into top class players. He did an incredible job. So I'm wondering, and is it unfair? I'm not sure. Is it the fact that the expectation, PSG was the expectation to win everything, win the Champions League even, but nowhere near it. Chelsea, there is an expectation to deliver silverware. It might be a little bit different now with the different ownership. Yeah. So is it a club thing?
I don't know, because why is the expectation of Chelsea this season? They finished 12th last year. They were terrible all season long, pretty much.
But the fans, right? If you talk about the history of Chelsea, and especially when I say the history, the last 10, 15 years of what they've done and what they've accomplished, right? That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, for sure.
That expectation at that club right now is to deliver almost every year a trophy. It is actually every year.
But I think also they all know that this is the start of a new project and it would take time. The problem is that we have not seen any improvement. We said that since day one of the Pochettino new era. And the issue I have with him, which we saw in Paris 100%, and I guess maybe towards the end of his time at Spurs, is the sort of in-game management. Where, remember Phil, the loss against Juventus at Wembley in the Champions League with Spurs, where Juventus scored back-to-back goals and Spurs were in complete control. And then he was there on the touchline, just frozen, not knowing what to do. Go back to the...
PSG Real Madrid.
Thank you, I was going to say. Unfortunately for me, we were both there in the stadium together. And PSG, 2-0 on aggregate, cruising at halftime. Karim Benzema scores the third goal in the second half. And Poch has no idea what to do, how to stop the momentum going, shifting the Real Madrid way. And in the end, we end up losing. And there's those moments where really, he's a great manager, but sometimes to me, he looks clueless on the touchline of what am I supposed to do here? My team is getting battered, overrun, overplayed. I'm getting outsmarted by the guy next to me on the other dugout. I don't know what to do. And I saw it yesterday against Everton. I saw, yesterday, if you listen to the show on Monday, I saw it many times this season with Chelsea. And now more and more fans, I can see, or send me messages on social media saying, well, actually, we're seeing it too. And I'm just not sure what Poch is doing.
So, Jules, I want to ask you both this question. Same questions. There's two questions. What's a realistic target for Chelsea this season? And who's going to last longer, Poch or Ten Hag?
Phil, you go first.
You first, Jules.
Okay, if I go first, I still maintain that with the players that he has, and I agree with Phil that the squad is unbalanced, but they've had loads of injuries. We have to give them that for sure. They have like 10 players out. Look at Reece James again against Everton after 25 minutes or something. So the injuries are not his fault, right? They've had a lot of injuries. This is a team that is still good enough to finish top 8, maybe even top 6. I had them 6 at the start of the season to finish 6 at the end of the season. They right now, they're nowhere near as good as even a top 10 finish. So on that level is bad. And I would think that he would have more time than Ten Hag. So if one has to go, Ten Hag would be first.
Go on, Phil.
I agree with Jules. I agree with Jules. I think he's going to get more time than Ten Hag. And in terms of the realistic where they should finish, looking at the table here, they should finish above Brentford. They should finish above Fulham. They should finish above West Ham. And then it gets to Brighton, probably Newcastle. United, well, who knows? And then you've got the top 5. So I think, what you said at the start of the season, Jules, 6th or 7th is possibly what's looking most likely at the moment, given how everyone else is playing.
And let's not forget as well, Chorzy, before you go, Chelsea don't have any European competition this season. So it's not even like we could say Poch doesn't have time to put things in place. They can't train because they play every 3 days. They travel, they come back. No, they are free all week to prepare for the weekend. And the weekend, we see nothing.
Yeah, I'm actually a bit offended by you, Phil, because you said they'll finish above Fulham. And I'm telling you what, looking at their recent form, 3-2 against Wolves, they won. Obviously, a very, very entertaining game against Liverpool. Liverpool scored some unbelievable goals, 1-4-3. But Nottingham Forest and West Ham, brush them aside, 10 goals, 0 goals against in 2 games. And you're saying Chelsea's going to have above them. I'm not quite so sure at this moment in time. But yeah, it's going to be a struggle for Chelsea. And I agree. At the moment, like what Jules is saying, top 10, that actually looks at a push at the moment for Chelsea, the way that they're playing. So yeah, watch your space. Obviously, a lot of football still to be played. Aston Villa have got to be... Are they one of the surprise teams of the season so far, Phil? Are they? Are we surprised?
Not to me.
Yeah. I wonder why.
Listen, I am a massive fan of Unai Emery, and I had a feeling that he was going to get things together this season. And at the start of the campaign, I tipped them to be pushing for a Champions League. I didn't think that they would realistically be title contenders, but given the way that they're playing, given the position they're in, after 16 games, I don't think it's insane to suggest that they could be, if not title contenders, but they could certainly have something to say about the title race. Unai Emery is such a good manager, and I think people forget that because he couldn't pronounce the word evening in English, and he suddenly became this figure of fun during his time at Arsenal, where he did a pretty good job taking a really sort of middling squad, I would say, to 5th in the table and a European final. Did a good job there, but he somehow became this figure of fun. He is an elite coach, Unai Emery, who has won 4 Europa Leagues not with the biggest teams in Spain. Go anywhere and they will tell you that he made them a better team, apart from maybe Paris. But anywhere else will say that he has elevated this team, and without him, they were poorer. And that's what he's doing to Aston Villa now. And it's his insane attention to detail, his obsession. And I know all top coaches are really, really obsessed and really about the details, but not to this level, genuinely. I've spoken to a lot of players at different clubs who have worked with Unai Emery, and the level of perfection, obsession, detail that he has is, I think it's unsurpassed in the in the game. So he's not only is that helping him figure out games and plan games, but that also transmits to the players as well. So he's got this squad of players, and he hasn't brought in that many players. It's a similar squad that Steven Gerrard had. And these players are seeing this elite coach, and he is kind of elevating them. He's making them not only better players, but also, I think, have bigger aspirations as well. And they're saying, we've got this elite European coach here. We can do this. And we saw it against against Manchester City, the way they absolutely dominated. And this performance against Arsenal, it was a strong performance. They rode their luck a little bit. Arsenal had some chances. They weren't clinical enough. But it's another big performance. It's another home win. It's another example to anyone who questioned Unai Emery what a terrific coach he is. And yeah, they're absolutely flying.
Jules, what was the general sort of perception of Unai Emery at PSG? Because it didn't go to plan. Didn't go well for him there. And now you see what he's done and how he's performed elsewhere. I mean, how do they feel about him right now?
It's a good question. I mean, there were some really good things, like the first leg against Barcelona, of course, in the Champions League, that 4-0 win. The second leg, not so much.
What happened in the second leg? Remind us?
I can't remember. I can't remember. I think I was maybe out
was
of the...
Was it 5-0?
No, I can't remember really. Let me think.
It wasn't.
I don't think I was even on Earth that day. So I can't really... I could not tell you. I was traveling somewhere. But maybe there's a case away from that 6-1 remontada defeat, of course, was it? Because you wanted to torture me.
Yes.
Maybe he's great in an environment where... One, he feels really valued and he feels this is his club, and it's maybe not a club too big with too much egos.
That's it.
It feels like, listen, you don't really listen to what I'm saying. You're not really taking on board what I'm saying. Whereas Aston Villa, everybody loves him. All the players worship him, really, which was not the case in Paris, simply because they are arrogant in Paris with completely egomaniacs. And it worked to a certain extent, but I don't think Unai really could implement all his ideas because of the dressing room that he had there, and because the club was too bling-bling for him, which is not him at all. And maybe for that pressure and expectations of, you know, you have to go and win the Champions League, otherwise you're a failure. Because this is not... Unai Emery would never be defined whether he won the Champions League in Paris or not in 18 months that he was there. So I love the fact that he does well. I love the fact that he says right now, yeah, we are in the title race. Because he would lie otherwise. And I also love the fact, on the back of what Phil just said, that they can win against City by controlling the game and being the team that dominated the most City in the Guardiola era. Really, we've never seen City that bad. But then also grind out a result like they did against Arsenal, where they were maybe not the better team on the day, and yet they found a way of winning that as well 4 days after beating City. And if you have that kind of like variety almost in the way you play and what you can do, I think you are very, very good.
It just goes to show you, like you said there, Phil, before, about the fact that pretty much the same squad that Steven Gerrard had and what he's doing with it. I mean, Leon Bailey's a new player who's been exceptional. Again, saw him a lot in the Bundesliga, and he was a real talented player and a top-class player there. But gone to another level, Ollie Watkins, another one, John McGinn, Douglas Luiz, Yuri Tillemans is an interesting one as well, because... You know, I think back end of his time at Leicester didn't go particularly well, but there was a lot of players that struggled under Brendan Rodgers and Leicester that back end of the season. But he again is another player, and I think he's showing his true form and true colours under Unai Emery. So their biggest challenge is probably going to be at the end of the season keeping hold of someone like Unai Emery and the likes of Ollie Watkins and Leon Bailey, or so, if they keep going.
Maybe. I mean, in terms of Unai Emery... I think he'd be pretty happy here. He usually lasts a couple of seasons, two or three seasons, because he is so intense that he does wear the players down a little bit. But I'm not sure where else he'd go. I mean, I can't see a big Real Madrid or Barcelona wouldn't come in for him, and unless Manchester United or Chelsea come in for him, there's nowhere else that he would go. So I reckon he'll stick around for a little bit longer. And I'm interested to see if they improve their away form a little bit, because that has been the question mark, because they've been so strong at home, but they haven't been picking up results away from home. And there's been just a slight sort of showing that potentially that could change. I was I was in North London to see them somehow beat Spurs 2-1 a couple of weeks ago in a game where they rode their luck and then came into it in the second half and managed to win. And then they got that late draw away to Bournemouth. So those are two positive results on the road. The next away game is against Brentford. Then they got Manchester United on Boxing Day. So if they can start pick up results away from home as well as continue this sensational form at home, then they are title contenders, absolutely.
And Jules, do you think they're title contenders?
Yeah, of course they are. They should be. It'd be interesting to see how they do in the new year, comes February, March, in Europe and in the league. And again, they've done well so far, but this was a group stage where the other teams in their group was, you know, were decent, but nothing special. When it comes to maybe reaching the quarterfinal, etc., then maybe the challenge would be a bit better. And also, we talked about injuries for Chelsea. We've had injuries at Spurs, for example. There's been a lot of injuries at Newcastle. They have had no injuries at all so far. And that has been obviously to their benefit. So let's hope it stays like that. Because if injury starts creeping in as well after the new year, after the very crazy festive period, then it might be different. But for now, of course, they are title contenders. They've been amazing.
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say no.
How can you say no, Schwartzy?
Because it's 16 games in and they haven't got the experience nor the know-how at this moment in time. I'm going to say it's Liverpool, Arsenal, Man City to win the title. But let's talk about it again. Let's revisit it when we're 25 games in, 28 games in, and then we can start talking about who is there or thereabouts, whether or not they're genuine title contenders. Because I think at the moment it's too early to say, and certainly for a team like Aston Villa, not for the teams like Liverpool, Arsenal and Manchester City, because they know what it takes. They've been there. Done it.
It's not too early to say, because we say at the start of the season, you know, who do we think is going to win the title, and we give our predictions then, and now we're 16 games in and we're just judging it on what we've seen.
What did we all say? Who's going to win the league? We went for the ones that generally win the league. Exactly. So they're the teams that know how to do it with the type of managers and type of players who've got the experience to do it time and time again. That's what we do, right?
But no one said here that Aston Villa are going to win the title. We have said they are going to contend and be battling for the title potentially at the end of the season.
But I still don't think they're contenders right now. Okay. Nor are Spurs. Certainly Man United, definitely not. That's for sure. Let's not even go there.
Yeah.
the other thing I want to say is, we talked about Chelsea and about whether Poch keeps his job, and they don't have a plan. They don't have a direction. And I said, Wood Villa's biggest task would be possibly, or challenge, is to keep hold of Unai Emery. So I'm thinking, would it be a better, like an option for him potentially? Would it be better for Chelsea to go and get someone like Unai Emery?
Jules, go first. On. Yeah. I mean,
could you see that working?
No, yeah, of course. But would he want to go there in the first place with a squad of, they still have, I think, 30 players or 29 players in the contract or something ridiculous like that.
A lot to choose from.
A lot to choose for. Well, I like what he did at Aston Villa. And again, going back to feeling, you know, feeling loved, feeling happy, feeling at the center of everything. Right now, Aston Villa is Unai Emery's club. The director of football, he's his friend for 20 years. The sporting director, Monchi, is his friend for many, many years. I think there's 16 members of staff who are all Spaniards. All brought in by Unai. I'm not saying this is a bad thing or good. I'm just saying this is why this is working so well, because he has restructured all the footballing side of the club, because the club has
exactly what Chelsea needs.
True. But you can't. I mean, if Chelsea said, "Hey, Unai, bring all your structure to us," then maybe he would. But can you imagine bringing all those people from Villa to Chelsea? That's why I agree with Phil. I think he's going to stay at Villa for a while, even if they might lose, let's say, Pau Torres or Watkins or Douglas Luiz there and there. But if they qualify for the Champions League next season, nobody's going to leave. You're not going to leave Villa without Unai Emery after finishing first, second, third or fourth or fifth, because even fifth will qualify for Champions League. So I think what he's done is great in terms of restructuring the club, even if all these people, it's working. So this is great. And leaving that behind now to go to Chelsea and starting all over again, I'm not sure. But yeah, would Chelsea need someone like him? For sure. I'm not sure right now he would leave Villa to go to Chelsea.
And if Villa do lose people in the summer, remember, they've got the best sporting director in the world in Monchi to go out and find someone else. So it's all set up pretty well for Villa. They've got a good project, and this word get bandied around a lot in football, doesn't it? But this is like the epitome of a strong, exciting project.
Yeah, look, I just wanted to say it, and I want Chelsea to be better than what they're doing, right? So, and I think, you know, I'm a big fan, and I think he's brilliant. So, look, in the grand scheme of things, for more competitiveness in the Premier League, we need managers like that to be spread across different teams and different clubs. Totally understand it. So, before Villa fans absolutely hammer me, which they will anyway, that's fine. I get it. But yeah, look, take it as a positive. They're doing so well, and you know, Emery is so good. We're going to talk about it, aren't we? We're going to throw some curveballs out there. Let's go to the WSL update. Narelle and Ash from our women's football wrap. Take a look at Arsenal's remarkable win over Chelsea.
Thanks, Schwartzy. Well, yes, the top of the table clash did not disappoint, did it, Ash? Arsenal getting a huge win over Chelsea in front of a record crowd for a WSL match.
Yeah, 59,000 people. How good is that to see at the Emirates? And apparently they've already sold 25,000 for the next game there. So they're like flying. And the Arsenal team were flying too, weren't they?
Did you expect that result?
No, probably not that convincing. But like almost nothing went wrong for them on the day. They like outplayed them with their combination play. They outplayed them organisationally. They worked so hard for each other. And I tell you, it was great to see Kim Little back because she can be an absolute star for them. And she was bombing up and down the midfield. She was so impressive to watch for them coming back from injury. And, you know, I think it was just a great, great performance by Arsenal, probably less so from Chelsea.
Yeah, what do you think went wrong for Chelsea then?
Maybe they just got, you know, outplayed on the day. I think Emma Hayes was, like, completely disappointed with their performance. What did she say after the game?
Yeah, she said the only positive was that she only had a 20-minute drive to get home, which I love.
It was great, wasn't it? It was a great line. But, you know, I think she said, you know, they were outplayed in every aspect of the game, which is probably a great description of it. For some reason, they weren't up for it. Maybe it was a little bit of a hangover after the international break, but, you know, Arsenal had plenty of players away as well, and I think we're really just starting to see Arsenal hit their straps. Like this is the sort of Arsenal we can see when they're playing, you know, top level.
Yeah, it was Chelsea's first defeat of the season. But we heard Sam Kerr post-match there. She said, "We're Chelsea, it's fine, it's sweet." And then also we saw a video for her social media. She was stuck in traffic and she gave the old four fingers up to Arsenal fans just to remind everyone that they've won four titles on the bounce. Mm. Do you think maybe this is almost not awoken the beast, but do you think they'll be very hard to beat from here because they know what defeat tastes like now and they won't want that again?
Maybe, yeah. Maybe Arsenal's done everyone else a disservice here. But, like, you know, Sam's a very confident person and that she, you know, opposite to Emma Hayes, didn't show any humility in defeat, sort of reinforced that confidence, which I think you probably want in your players. But, you know, every other team, if I'm watching that as an opposition player and I see Sam react like that after a game, I'm just as motivated to go after them as they are to not experience defeat again.
Another incident that we have to talk about was involving Lauren James. So she stomped on a player at the World Cup and she's done something similar in this match. It wasn't as bad, but it was still pretty reckless and pretty stupid. Yeah. Do you think she'll get any repercussions from that?
I don't know. It depends on what she got a yellow card from as to what the match review panel can sort of act on. So I think we'll wait and see what comes of that. But I think it'd be good for her if she did get punished again because she obviously didn't learn from that episode at the World Cup. She's, you know, not getting what she wants on the field and she chucks a tantrum. It's not a good look.
Chelsea and Arsenal, joint top, they've got the same amount of points, but both of them have had pretty contrasting seasons and different paths to get there.
Yeah, they have. And it'll be interesting to see where they go from here. They'll have that sort of December, January break and we'll see who, you know, everyone knows you don't win the comp at Christmas time. You win it afterwards. Okay. So we'll see who's top of the league come May.
Yeah, well, it was a pretty exciting weekend nonetheless. Schwartzy, did anyone see that one coming?
Did anyone see this coming? Yes, I did. Arsenal playing at home at the Emirates, nearly 60,000 people. The game has been built up over the last sort of 3-4 weeks. 45,000 tickets were sold many weeks ago, and we're talking about just under 60,000 people turned up to watch Jonas Adevelt's Arsenal. They've got Beth Mead back, who's been absolutely outstanding, obviously back in the England setup as well. Caitlin Ford, we all know, has been absolutely brilliant. Victoria Pavlova has had an outstanding, probably the last 12 months, let's be honest. The injuries to Arsenal last season certainly helped her and elevated her to a big, big player for Arsenal. And of course, one of my favourite players in the WSL is Alessia Russo. I think she's absolutely brilliant and she scored two great goals against Chelsea. And then you look at Arsenal on the bench, Blackstinius, Miedemar, who is a phenomenal player, and of course, our own Cooney Cross. So yeah, I did see it coming, and I said it earlier on. Not playing Champions League football for Arsenal could be a blessing in disguise. So it's game on, and I think it's great for the WSL because we just don't want people to run away with the league, just like with the Premier League. We want it to be as competitive as possible to the very end, like it was last season, of course. Next, we're going to talk about La Liga, of course, Phil's favourite subject, of course, and this is where he's in his absolute element. And even on top of that, it's Barcelona against Girona. Phil, come on, it's your chance. Tell us what happened. What was the score?
Hashtag always watch Girona. I've been, you know, I was trying to see the first time I actually tweeted that. And I think I did my Opta Sport column on the 7th of March this year, using that hashtag and sort of saying how great Girona are to watch and what a great team. They beat Barcelona 4-2 last night away.
In Barcelona. Barcelona as well.
Yeah, 100 kilometers down the road from Girona. It was a Catalan derby. It's the first time ever that they've won away to Barcelona. And they were just incredible. It was a sensational game in terms of entertainment. Barcelona had a few chances, but Girona had plenty more. And I think the last 20 minutes of the first half was basically the best football I've seen any team play in La Liga this season. And Girona just completely tore apart Barca in such a sort of stylish way, in a kind of Barcelona style way. The positional play, the overlapping runs, the creating superiority in really dangerous positions. Everybody knew exactly what they needed to do. And they've got belief now. They've got genuine belief that they can beat anyone in this division. They've only lost once all season, and that was to Real Madrid in a game where they had plenty of chances at the start as well. They didn't take them on that occasion, but they did last night. And we're talking about Girona, obviously, because, you know, I like to big myself up and say that I can spot trends before. But we're also talking about them because they're top of the league, Mark. They're 2 points clear of Real Madrid at the top of the table after 16 games. And we're talking about competitive title races and whether Aston Villa are in the title race. Are Girona in the title race? Of course they are, because they've shown that they're the best team in Spain at the moment. They are the best team in Spain at the moment. They've won more games. They've scored more goals. They're 2 points clear at the top of the table. They don't have European football either. They've got a squad that's more limited than their opponents. It's true, but actually it's not a bad squad. We saw some strength in depth off the bench last night. Christian Stuani coming off the bench to score. He's a legendary figure. And
Middlesbrough legend.
He's still going. And actually I've got people in the UK messaging me going, what's going on with Girona? They've got Paolo Gazzaniga in goal. Daley Blind is playing at centre-back. Stuani's up front for them. Eric Garcia at centre. What's going on? And somehow this group of, I don't want to say, you know, English football rejects, but players that have been in English football and not necessarily shone, but have turned up in Catalonia under a brilliant, brilliant manager and are playing terrific football. So always watch them, guys. Always watch Girona.
Jules, are you buying that? Like, are they the best team in Spain?
Yeah, completely. I watched them pretty much all season, probably on the advice of Phil as well,
yes,
in the hashtag.
Yes.
I just love it. I just love how, I mean, to start with, the fitness that they're showing and how the way they go for the intensity that they put in a game. And again, it's not direct football. It's not just looping the ball. And it's just that the intensity they play with, I think, is fantastic. What Mitchell has done with those players, Tsigankov, Dovbik, Jan Couto, I mean, all of them. It's really remarkable, the blend in that team between the experience, the youth, players who've been in that league before, players who have never been in La Liga before and having a big impact. We talked about in-game management earlier with Pochettino, for example. Both Valeri and Stuani coming off the bench yesterday and scoring, which I think Xavi, with the four substitutions that he made, nobody had that kind of impact for Barcelona. And I think it's great. They have 41 points now with 3 games to go before the halfway mark of the season. So they're en route for a 50-point first half of the season, like Atletico did when they won the title 2 years ago, which would be incredible. They have to play Alaves at home, then Betis away, then Atletico Madrid at home. The last 2 games will be on the other side of the in 2024. But you could say they only lost to Real Madrid this season. That was 3-0. And even that 3-0 was a harsh result, right, Phil? Remember, they had chances. The XG was really decent. So they are really, really phenomenal, I think.
Xavi. I mean, excuse did he give after the game? What did he say? Whose fault was it? It wasn't his, of course.
Are you? Do you not actually know what he said? He said, we are in a transition. We are a team in transition. In his third season, he came out and said we're a team in transition, which has obviously not gone down well with large swathes of supporters. He also said that they played well, that they had chances. He gave the statistics of the number of shots that they created, and he didn't really seem willing to accept the idea that they were completely outplayed, which they were for large, large parts of the game. And it's funny because he was under serious pressure and they had 3 big games coming up in a row. They had a game against Porto in the Champions League, which they had to win. They did. They had a game against Atletico Madrid, which was billed as a must-win game to stay in the title race, which they did. And they actually played pretty well. Atleti playing terribly, terribly, terribly in the first half. And then they had this game against Girona. So of these three games, they won two, but failed really quite seismically against Girona last night. And the pressure is still there. And not only is the pressure there because Barcelona aren't consistently playing the way that people want them to play, but just in terms of the number, they're 7 points off top spot now, with 16 games gone. And 7 points is Girona losing three games and Barca winning three games to overtake them. So it's a really, really poor position. And I do not buy that they are in a transitional period at all. Sorry. It's difficult when you lose Lionel Messi. It's difficult when you have to do the palancas to try and sign
anyone. You're not bringing up Lionel Messi. So you're not bringing up Lionel Messi still, right? I mean, how long ago was that he left? You can't say they're in transition because they've got Lionel Messi.
What other transition are they in? I know. What other transition are they in there? Okay, economically, they're in a difficult situation. Okay, it's been like that for a few years now. Just sort of get on with it, you know. So, yeah, it's another game where they've been outplayed and haven't played as the fans expect them to. And the pressure continues to build on Xavi, who I don't think, you know, he's not going to be sacked before the end of the season. That's not going to happen. Absolutely not. He's going to stay there and
watch his space.
It's not going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen at all. But, you know, it's they're not progressing as they were supposed to. Let's put it like that.
I'll go back to Girona. Will they do a Leicester style run and win the league? I'm more confident about, we talked about Villa before. I'm actually, what I've seen from Girona as well, I'm thinking, you know what, this could potentially be a Leicester.
The L word is getting bandied around a lot. They had the sporting director of Girona on the radio this morning, and they said to him, you know, what do you think about when you hear the word Leicester? And he says, oh no, you know, that's it sounds like a joke to me. The first time people said the word Leicester, it sounded like a joke, but now they're starting more and more to believe that they can do something important this season. The first thing that Michel said yesterday, by the way, at his press conference, is that we've got 41 points, we're safe now, which just gives you an idea of the mentality of the team at the start of the season. It was to be safe and then to try and build something on last season where they finished 10th. Getting European football would be a big achievement for them. But at the moment, where they are now, they're 12 points clear of Real Sociedad, who are fifth. So they're 12 points clear. They're not guaranteed a Champions League spot, but they would have to collapse spectacularly to not get into the Champions League, which would be a magnificent achievement. They can do a Leicester. They can do a Leicester. And if they do a Leicester, it will be bigger than Leicester doing a Leicester, because the way La Liga is structured, it is more unbalanced than the Premier League. Girona are a much smaller club compared to Real Madrid and Barcelona than Leicester are compared to Manchester United and Manchester City, or were at that time. So it would be bigger. It would be bigger if it happened, and it can happen. I don't necessarily think that it will happen. I think Real Madrid are still favourites to win the title. I've been, and I'm sticking to that. I said that at the start of the season, I'm sticking with it, even though they're 2 points off top spot. But yeah, we've got this storyline in La Liga, which we've needed for a while. And a couple of years ago, it was Atletico Madrid being this fairy tale. And now Atletico Madrid have sort of become this European juggernaut under Diego Simeone, reached two Champions League final, and they're no longer the plucky outsiders. There's a big three, and it's been crashed by Girona. So it's a terrific story. And they're doing it in such an attractive way as well, which just adds to the whole notion of you can be successful and play brilliant football at the same time.
If there's one weakness that they have, what is it? How do you see, if it's going to come unstuck, what's going to be the thing that's going to get them unstuck?
I mean, you know, the obvious thing to say is injuries. They haven't had any major sustained injuries this season, although they were missing Yangel Herrera in midfield against Barcelona, who's been one of their best midfielders, and he wasn't there, and they found a way to play the veteran David Lopez there and completely dominate Barcelona. So injuries, they don't have European football, obviously. And yeah, I'm not going to say a loss of belief, because I think belief is growing and confidence is growing, and confidence in the manager's idea and how he wants them to play. And they believe that can be successful. Like they don't change that, you know, a bit like Ange with Spurs, they don't change their style against who they play. It's like, we'll get away to Barca, we'll be a bit more defensive, we'll sit back, we'll invite pressure, hit them on the counter-attack. Absolutely not. And the fact that they won away to Barcelona will just reinforce all the ideas that they have. So yeah, I can't see too many weaknesses at the moment.
Jules, Phil said that he said that Real Madrid are the favourites to win the league. He's pretty much written off Barcelona. Do you write Barcelona off as well? Or do you think it's Real Madrid's to win?
I think it is Real Madrid's to win, especially when Jude Bellingham is in that kind of form. There's no doubt. I think Girona will be there all the way. And yeah, it would be extraordinary for them to go and win it. I think Atletico, who, let's not forget, have a game in hand, by the way, to still play against Sevilla, will also, I think, be in the mix. And right now, you have to say the Barca is the worst team of them four. There's just no doubt. So for them to win the league this season, they will have to improve massively in the second half of the season. We know that they probably won't be able to sign anybody in January because the money is just not there. So you can't even like ask for something. If you're Girona right now, you look at January transfer window and you think, okay, maybe just one, two signings with the help, obviously, of the City Group, maybe a loan or two, like we see with Savio, who's one of the revelations of the season. And then you make this squad even better and to prevent potential injuries, like Phil just said. If you're Barcelona, I don't think, and Deco, I think, said it after the game yesterday, he said, we need to win games before even thinking about new signings, keeping the players that we have on loan, like Cancelo and Joao Felix. So this is not where Barca are. So I don't know how they make up the gap first and in terms of points, but also they will have to really focus on working to improve the performances of the team collectively to be able to catch up with Real Madrid, Girona and Atletico.
Did Real Madrid miss an opportunity, Phil, on the weekend? They draw away at Betis. I mean, probably I think they were a bit lucky probably even to get a draw in the end.
Well, Isco had a terrific chance right at the end, a header that came off the post, and that would have been an unbelievable story if Isco had scored the winner against Real Madrid, his former club. But away to Betis is a, you know, it's a tough place to go, and it's one of the places that feasibly at the start of the season, Real Madrid might look down the fixture list and say, oh, okay, we might drop some points there because it is a difficult place to go. Betis are on a long, long unbeaten streak as well. They've been one of the form teams in the division, and they played well in the second half, Betis. Real Madrid dominated in the first half. We had Modric and Kroos in midfield, rolling back the years. Then Modric got subbed in the second half and wasn't particularly happy at all.
He's never happy these days, is he?
He wants to play.
It's a love-hate relationship with him and Ancelotti, right?
Yeah. Him and Ancelotti are not getting on at the moment. But yeah, Jude Bellingham didn't necessarily have his best game, but he scored a really excellent goal and another different kind of goal as well. I think I spoke a couple of weeks ago about him scoring different kinds of goals, and he's added yet another one. We hadn't seen him breaking through the lines, breaking the offside trap, running onto a ball, controlling it down and finishing first time. It's a different element of his attacking play, which we hadn't seen before. We've seen him score headers, scrappy goals from the 6-yard box, individual runs from 35 yards out, smash the ball in from 40 yards. He can do everything. He's a complete player. And even when he's not dominating the game, he's decisive, as he was against Betis. Rodrigo played really well in this game. Didn't score, but looked so, so dangerous. And his form is going to be really important for Real Madrid. So I think it was a good game. It was an attractive game to watch. And Carlo Ancelotti was happy after the game. He's like, I'm happy with the point. It was a good point. They're a good team. They played well. We could have lost. We did all right. So yeah, if he's happy, then I think, you know, it's fair to say that a draw was the fair result.
I'm a little bit concerned about Jude Bellingham. I mean, his form's dropped a little bit. He's only scored 12 and 14 now. So that's a little bit concerning for Jude Bellingham and his form in Real Madrid, of course.
Rubbish.
Phil, I want to ask you, because you're on the ground, obviously, and you've talked about in the past about how two different types of media, one from Barcelona and one from Madrid. And have the Barcelona media even started, or have they even mentioned Jude Bellingham and the quality that he has?
No, of course not. What do you mean, mentioned him? I mean, listen, it's very, very, very partisan. There are news stories about Bellingham. I think I read in Sport yesterday, there was a factual news piece that Jude Bellingham is top of the goal scorer charts. Okay, but you know, do not expect the Catalan media to start praising Jude Bellingham, and if he does, then you know that he's really doing something historic. I mean, I said a few weeks ago, what he is doing is historic. No one's ever started life at Real Madrid like this, and he's continuing to do it. If he gets the Catalan media to praise him and say he's an unbelievable player, then yeah, that really will be particularly memorable.
Do you have that as well, Jules? Do you have that in France as well? Like a real Paris central media, or is it just a total similar across the whole country?
Different. It's different, but this is quite unique, to be fair. I mean, to start with, in France, we only have one only sports newspaper, daily newspaper in L'Équipe. So they cover the whole country. It's not like you have one in Paris, one in Marseille, for example. You know, it's not like the two that you have in Madrid and the two that you have in Barcelona. In Italy, it's maybe a little bit the same because you still have, you know, some newspaper from Turin, like Tutto Sport, for example.
Tutto Sport, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But still, it's still not as divided as, you know, as Marca and Sport and Mundo Deportivo on the other side. This is really, really like proper to Spain.
Phil, one other question I wanted to ask you was, Lunin has kept his position in goal. Arrizabalaga has been back. He's been back fit for a couple of weeks now, but Lunin's been absolutely exceptional. Are you a little bit surprised? I'm a little bit surprised just because obviously it was a bit of a disaster when Courtois got injured. They needed to bring someone in and Arrizabalaga went straight in. And every time I've watched Lunin play, he's always done really well.
Yeah, it's actually quite surprising because Carlo Ancelotti seemed to be pretty clear that Kepa was his first choice this season with Courtois out. And when he got injured, Lunin would come back in. But he actually made the mistake in a press conference a couple of weeks ago saying, yeah, Lunin's going to play the next game, but Kepa will be back for the Betis match. And all the vicious Madrid media jumped on this and said, how can he be doing this? It's not fair. Lunin's been playing so well. He can't say that Kepa's going to come straight back in. It's out of order. And I don't know if he was influenced by the media or he took a step back, but Kepa did not start the game against Betis. Lunin kept his place. And it's been I wouldn't say a metamorphosis, but last season when Lunin had to play in a couple of games where Courtois was injured, he did not inspire a lot of confidence. I think people knew he was a good goalkeeper, but he hadn't shown it consistently at a high level, but he hadn't necessarily been given a chance to do it. And now he has, and he has been really impressive. And to be honest, I'm not a massive fan of Kepa. I think he has certain question marks, and I didn't agree that he should be the number one for Real Madrid without any kind of question. And the questions have been asked now by Lunin. I think midweek we'll see Kepa come back in the Champions League because it's more or less a game that doesn't matter. But then the real question is who's going to play at the weekend because it feels like Lunin is number one for Real Madrid at the moment.
Well, that's all we've got time for. I want to thank Phil and Jules for joining me this week. And of course, if you don't already do it, hashtag always watch Girona. And of course, every game of the Premier League, La Liga and the WSL are all live on Optus Sport. See you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.